Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, February 18th. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us on the line is virologist Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. He's ready to take your questions about the COVID-19 vaccine and the virus in general. If you have a question for Dr. Yeager, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. VoxPopWAMC.org is the email address, and the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Eric Yeager, your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Joining us on the line today is Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Dr. Yeager has a PhD in biomedical sciences from the University at Albany. He teaches virology, biology, microbiology, and genetics at the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. He is ready to take your questions about COVID-19, the vaccine, and the virus in general. He has been on the show many times since the pandemic began, and he is a wealth of knowledge. We're really lucky to have him here. So if you have a question for Dr. Yeager, get in line early. There's still a few open lines. Soon enough, there will be none. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpopwamc.org. And once again, that's first come, first serve. Dr. Yeager, welcome back. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing well. Great to be here, Ray. Hope you're doing well and 2021's treating you and your family well.
Yeah, pretty good. And we're looking forward to the end of this thing, although it may still be... This may still be a while.
We're getting closer.
Hey, what is your personal experience with vaccine research?
So my background is really in viruses, and that is partly like how viruses work, but also a lot of the research I've been doing since I got my PhD is on how our immune system responds to the virus, and with that, how to develop vaccines. So my history is did a lot of work trying to develop a universal flu vaccine using DNA. A DNA platform, which I can explain a little bit, but just a different type of vaccine in hopes of making a universal flu vaccine. This is, again, pre-COVID. I'd also done a lot of research in the past looking at how the older immune system functions differently than a younger immune system, with the idea of hopefully developing vaccines and different therapies that can help older individuals. So kind of a bit of an interest of mine throughout my research career.
You know, it's been confusing, and you've been on so many times, and there have been so many confusing things, and our head spins. You hear one thing and another, but there are several different vaccines worldwide, and you know there is a certain amount of trepidation among a certain population throughout the world. They don't want to take vaccines. What do you know about the safety of this one, and in general, the COVID-19 vaccines you've seen?
Certainly. So as you mentioned, Ray, part of it is the novelty of these vaccines. So they are newer platforms that haven't been used widely in people before, like the messenger RNA vaccines and the adenovirus vaccines. So it's been kind of thinking about how we've come this past year in my role as a scientist is really educating people about what these platforms are and how do they work, because they are different than vaccines you may have gotten in childhood and currently. So once people understand that scientists do have an idea of how these vaccines work and that the testing process that was followed, even though it was rapid, it was not rushed, is that there was robust studies performed to assess the safety and efficacy of these vaccines. So the companies, for example, Pfizer and Moderna with their mRNA vaccines, they were very transparent with how their studies were designed. They were sure to include populations at risk, so different racial ethnic groups. They want to make sure they got the right age, the right demographics for people that would be at the highest risk, and also to make sure the vaccine would work effectively and be safe in all populations that potentially could take it. So their studies really were comprehensive. They really did track all the side effects. And looking at the data that was released, again, it's been kind of a whirlwind, as you mentioned, of kind of like where we were a year ago to the amount of information on the virus and these vaccines that was developed. But these companies really put out a lot of information because they really understood that people would want this information, and we need to develop vaccine confidence and trust. And this is one way to do it, is to supply that information and not by a press release like, hey, our vaccine works, trust us, really have the data out there so that clinicians, scientists can look at it, but also people in public can have a chance to look at the information and see what it really tells. And looking at that data myself, I was very confident that the vaccines were tested. There's a lot of different pieces of information that were supplied to the FDA and the CDC before these vaccines could even be used in the public. And it was really looked at by people that were independent of the companies and the government. I know, unfortunately, last year, kind of the vaccines got a bit politicized. But the people that looked at it, they are individuals like myself that are experts in science and healthcare and vaccines, looked at the data. Again, they had no bias, just looking at it. Is this vaccine safe and effective? Would I take it? Would I give it to my family? And if that was the case, release it.
Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest, and I got to be honest, Eric, the last time you were on, I got an email from somebody who said, "Will you shut up, Ray? You asked too many questions." So I'm going to let people ask questions here. I got one more for you. You mentioned the mRNA vaccine. Yeah. What is an mRNA vaccine?
Sure. So for the mRNA vaccine, if you think about the virus, and we talked about in the past how the virus has a blueprint, and the virus uses that blueprint to make more copies of itself inside our cells. So viruses can't do that on their own. They need our cells to access all our construction equipment to make more copies of itself. So the mRNA vaccine is taking a piece of that blueprint, giving it to our cells, our construction crews inside our cells, to start making that protein. And then once that protein's produced, it educates our immune system to recognize that protein so that if the person is actually infected with the real live virus, they can respond against it and should be protected. So it's just a piece of information about the virus. It is not a killed virus. It is not a live virus. You can't get COVID from this vaccine. It's simply providing some information for our bodies to respond to that virus should you be exposed to it.
All right, let's do a few emails here before we take our break, and then we'll hit the phones. Eric Yeager is our guest, Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. This email came in at like 8:45 this morning. You have a big stack of email awaiting you. This one's from Chris. And Chris says, at the rate of vaccine distribution in the United States, it seems that those on the lower priority list, like young adults and kids, won't be inoculated until the later part of the year. With multiple COVID variants spreading around the world, how can we ensure that our current vaccines will still be effective by then, and then we don't have to start over?
That's a great question. And again, there was a race to develop these vaccines, and now the race is really to get enough people vaccinated to achieve herd immunity. And I think we've talked about that in the past, Ray, where herd immunity is we need to get a certain percentage of the community vaccinated so that the virus can't spread. And there is a concern is right now the vaccine is only accessible to a certain amount of people, and it's really hard. It's like winning the lottery trying to get a vaccine. So How can we ever get to that 70%+ we need to get? It's been encouraging to see that the manufacturers are producing more. They're supplying more, so we will get there. Currently, the vaccines have not been tested in children younger than 16. There are studies ongoing to kind of what companies do is a age de-escalation. So they look at adults first, then young adults, then adolescents, and then young children. So we're getting there. So it is, I want to make clear that not all populations have been cleared to use the vaccine yet. So kids hopefully will have the ability to vaccinate children maybe in summer or fall.
Okay. Go ahead.
What we do know is that much of the spread of the virus is not by children. It's by adults between the ages of 20 and I believe like 39. So we want to get a certain population that's out there that has the potential to be exposed and carry it back to someone that's susceptible. So that's a population we want to hit. And you can see why there was a phase in between, okay, let's first get the people at risk, like first responders, medical personnel. And then they decided to, okay, we need to protect those that are most vulnerable. And we'll kind of expand that out. And we will get eventually to that 70%+ we need for herd immunity.
Is the 70% a hard and fast number? In other words, if a certain percentage of the population had this virus and were asymptomatic, is there any immunity built that way that you have seen yet?
Yeah, it's the number is just a calculation based off what we know of how the virus is transmitted in the percentage of susceptible people in the community. So you've seen numbers as low as 70, numbers as high as 90%, so it's really hard to figure out which is the actual number. Mm-hmm. But what is known is that in looking at the data for people that were potentially exposed and had a natural infection that were asymptomatic compared to vaccine immunity, the data is emerging that it looks like vaccine driven immunity is more robust. You have a better response against the virus and it may be more durable. Okay. There's some uncertainty and there's still data being collected for, what's the natural immunity? Because you can get herd immunity through infection or through vaccination. The other benefit, in addition to maybe the immunity is better with vaccination, is that you can avoid the whole risk of getting disease and complications from COVID. Because we do know that even in asymptomatic cases, there could be long-term complications to infection.
This one's from Laura. What are your thoughts on whether long haulers should receive the vaccine, as there has been little research on those patients who are still suffering with lingering symptoms after the initial infection? Is there any risk of an overactive immune response?
That's a great question. There's a lot that's still being studied about the long hauler phenomenon and why do individuals experience disease severity long after they've been shown to be clear of the virus. So I think it's an unfortunate situation that these people have these long-term symptoms, but there's still a lot we don't understand. I don't know of any data that suggests they couldn't get vaccinated. I think there's always a risk that someone could become re-exposed. And I guess it's always the risk versus benefit. So if we get someone vaccinated versus if they were naturally infected, there could be more complications on top of what they're already experiencing. But I'm sure that's a group, as we get more information, they'll be looked at more carefully in terms of different therapies and vaccines.
Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest. Eric, we'll take a quick break here, and then we will get a couple of more emails in and then hit the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC, Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. We talk COVID-19 and the virus and the vaccines with Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy. Two quick emails and then to the phones we go. This is from Anna. I'm 16 weeks pregnant and eligible for the COVID vaccine in New York. What's your view on if, when I should get it? Should I wait until the third trimester? I'd like to be able to pass down antibodies to my baby while in utero, if possible. And that is from Anna in somewhere in New York.
That's another population that I've heard a lot from. I've had some friends and family members that are pregnant or thinking about getting pregnant, is can I get the vaccine? And first off, in terms of safety, we've looked at basically the information we have is looking at other vaccines and kind of use that as a guideline for when is it appropriate for someone that's pregnant to get the vaccine. And as Anna mentioned, one of the important aspects of the vaccine is that if you are vaccinated as a pregnant individual, you will make antibodies and those antibodies will protect your child as it's developing. And then you can pass it along after a child is born through breast milk. So there is a benefit to getting vaccinated. There is, again, probably I'd recommend she talk to her OBGYN to see if there's any other concerns in addition to that. Again, there were some initial concerns about this vaccine. We don't know about mRNA vaccines. Could it integrate into my DNA? And there's a lot of myths that we can maybe touch on, but one of them is that the mRNA is not going to pass into your DNA or your child. It's not going to give you cancer. Again, there's no live virus. It's going to develop an immune response in your body that can be passed to your child temporarily. And then eventually, as a child gets older, perhaps, you know, down the road, we'll have a child-based vaccine for COVID-19.
This email from Eric in Ulster County, and then we'll go to the phones. If young people are not vaccinated from COVID, is it safe to send them back to school without social distancing or wearing masks? Can vaccinated teachers and staff spread the disease? And that's from Eric in Ulster County.
Those are two great points. There is the idea that we have vaccines. They're highly effective. But it doesn't mean we can just stop following these safety practices like distancing and mask wearing, unfortunately. The vaccine does not make you bulletproof. So it does seem like it does have a high efficacy and protect you from disease, but we're still learning about what that means out in the community, what that means long term. And we still don't know if someone that's vaccinated can transmit the virus. So there's still a need, I believe, to follow those safety precautions in schools as well. There was some initial information with children that it was thought that children weren't able to spread the virus as readily as adults. So maybe they weren't really a concern. And the number of cases in children when schools began to reopen, it didn't seem to be the driver of community transmission that was at first thought. That was really unfortunately driven by home situations, people having kind of get-togethers or parties, not so much schools. Mm. So schools, if they do follow safety practices, and at the college where I teach, we're continuing to follow those safety practices, even with the vaccine. I think both measures will hopefully reduce the community transmission. And then we'll eventually start to get to a point where it is a bit safer to start reducing mask wearing and distancing. But we're not there yet.
Dr. Eric Yeager joins us from the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Ella is in Rensselaerville. Ella, you're on.
Hi. My name's Ellen. I'm a photographer, and something I've recently learned is that the same compound, H2S or sodium thiosulfate, I use to fix photographs is the same compound used to be therapeutic to COVID-19 patients by eliciting cytoprotection during oxidative stress. I understand how this chemical compound works in the photographic process. Can you explain how the compound, sodium thiosulfate, works in the biological and physiological process?
Ella, thanks for the question. So that's very interesting. I should look more up into that compound itself. But what is known is that with the COVID infection, people that have more severe forms of disease, it's thought perhaps it's an overreaction of the immune system. And one of the things that's produced in an immune response is reactive oxygen species. So I imagine that it's thought that these types of compounds might reduce the level of inflammation, reduce that reactive oxygen species that might prevent some of the tissue damage we see in individuals. Because we do know that COVID-19 infection impacts a variety of different systems and organs, like the respiratory tract, GI tract, and some neurological impacts as well. So perhaps the idea is that it causes less damage so that the virus can be cleared and that kind of collateral damage and that immune response is lessened.
Ella, thank you very much. Let's go to Jim in Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim.
Since the natural immunity conferred by the virus is said to be short in duration, how long is the immunity from the vaccine likely to last?
Great question, Jim. So you're correct that, well, the studies do suggest that with the natural infection, the immune response may last a few months, and it does kind of vary from person to person, whether they've had a severe case of disease or asymptomatic. So there's a lot of variability in how someone might respond to a natural infection. The one benefit of a vaccine is that a person is given a uniform dose of the vaccine, so the response should be a bit more consistent. So a lot of the studies that were done to establish that these vaccines were safe and effective did show as really strong antibody responses. And the levels that were seen in some studies that followed show that the durability looks pretty good. So those individuals that were part of that study is going to continue for another series of months to find out how long that is. Right now, we can say it's at least, probably 6 to 12 months. There's some things we have to figure out scientifically is, again, to continue people. Is that what we've seen in the clinical studies going to mirror out in the community? Because there are other variables that could impact a person's response to the vaccine. And additionally, too, is with the variants that Ray mentioned, is that, can these vaccines continue to be protective against these variants? Or may we have to go back and potentially get a booster shot or reformulation of vaccines in the future? So it's kind of a, it's still kind of a waiting pattern. Like I've told people out with this virus is, some things, the only thing we're certain about is the uncertainty. So we've learned a lot about the virus in the past year. And now it's really shifting to what's our immune response to that and how protective is that response long term.
Dr. Eric Yeager joins us today, and we're very lucky to have him several times during this pandemic. And this email, this came from Twitter, and it's a great question, and I've heard this many times from many people. What happens if I cannot find a second dose appointment for my 75-plus-year-old stepmother who got the first dose 2 weeks ago? So far, I can't get an appointment, and that's from Linda on Twitter.
Yeah, that's been when I myself got my shot. I got my first shot, and then I was thinking about that. What if I can't get that second shot?
Yeah.
So really the guidelines for how the vaccines were to be delivered were kind of set by those clinical trials. So depending on the vaccine, the Pfizer and Moderna mRNA vaccines, anywhere between 21 and 28 days. The CDC has kind of let out some maybe kind of flexibility. So you could maybe wait 6 weeks in between doses. So again, the typical 4 plus an additional 2, hopefully that's enough time to secure a second dose. There are some other guidelines it's not recommended to intermix the vaccines. So even though they are both mRNA vaccines, the same type, they're not the same formulation, like Coke versus Pepsi.
What could happen though?
I think a fear of a reaction or a safety issue. It's just that they don't know what the immune response will be because the number that they quote where, the 95 or 94% efficacy, those are people that received two doses of the same vaccine.
Right.
So that kind of got it gets a little bit into the discussion of why can't we just give everyone one shot and then just, you know, see what happens and then try to get everyone second shots eventually. And the issue is we do want people to be vaccinated. We want to get shots in arms, but when we vaccinate people, we want to make sure we're protecting them, that we can say with some level of certainty that they're protected for a certain level in a certain amount of time. If we start kind of playing around with the timing and the number of shots, then we kind of lose some of that certainty that we got from the really rigorous hard data from those clinical trials. So getting that second dose, and I can sympathize, it's not easy to get scheduled. In New York, it does seem, however, that the way that the doses are handled, that there are doses set aside so that when you get your first shot, there is a dose coming that is your second shot. So there is a system in place. As hard as it is to get a vaccine, as kind of chaotic it sometimes seems, there is a process to ensure that second doses are lined up.
Dr. Eric Yeager joins us. And back to the phones we go. 800-348-2551. John is in Canaan, is it? Where are you calling from, John?
Oh, Canaan, not Canaan.
Oh, it says Canaan here. Canaan. All right, well, Canaan. Welcome. You're on, either Canaan way.
In New Hampshire.
Oh, gotcha.
All right. So, Dr. Yeager, I had a immune condition that was treated with prednisone, started off with a very high dosage, 120 milligrams, and it's now down to quite low, around 2.5. And it's been at that level for about at least 6 months. I got my two vaccinations recently, and one of the attendants, when I got the vaccine, told me that because of the prednisone, I should know that my level of protection would be considerably less than the 94% or so, whatever they advertised. I got the Pfizer vaccine. So what I'm wondering is how less? Do you have any idea? I'm sure you don't have an exact idea, but can you give me some sort of ballpark ideas to how less than 94% I am protected?
Yeah, thanks, John, for your question. So the idea of prednisone, why would it impact the response to a vaccination? So so a drug like that has a suppressive activity on the immune system. So the idea is that if someone is taking this drug, it could lessen their response to that vaccine. So the attendee was basically suggesting that perhaps your immune response isn't going to be as strong as someone that wasn't on the drug. In terms of how much that would impact that, it probably will impact it to some degree. Again, there hasn't been a pretty robust study looking at that with the COVID-19 vaccines. Historically, individuals have looked at other vaccines like the flu vaccine or the pneumococcal vaccine, and it does seem to vary a bit with the individual, varies with the type of vaccine, but there is clearly some reduction. But I think it's safe to say with these vaccines, what we've realized, and especially with the variants coming up, people are concerned about this vaccine efficacy number, is that the 95% number is great now, but the number we really care about is this going to prevent you from getting a severe case of disease and have to be hospitalized? So I think, yes, perhaps your antibody levels might be different than someone that's not on prednisone, but the vaccine, in my opinion, should offer you enough protection that if you were exposed, if we can get it to like a mild cold, that's our goal, right? Is you know, best case scenario, we can prevent it from being transmitted into population, but if we can get this to something that we just think about kind of like the flu, not to minimize the flu, it does cause hospitalizations and deaths, but not to the degree of COVID-19. So if we can get that vaccine to still protect you from a severe case of disease and being hospitalized, that's a win. So I think the vaccine is still going to have some level of benefit for you. And in terms of what that new number is, again, I think it's really just an idea that you are protected from severe disease and still recommend following, again, safety practices out in the community.
Well, John, thank you very much for the call. Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest today from the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. And we go to Jill in Waterford. Jill.
Hi, gentlemen. How are you?
Good.
Hi, Jill.
My question is, with regards to the transmission of the disease, first off, how can you transmit it once you have the vaccine and you have waited the 2 or 3 week period for it to go through your system? If you can't transmit it, if you can't catch it, how can you transmit it? And if you can still transmit it, even though you've had the vaccine, even with herd immunity, how could we ever go back to normal?
That's a great question.
No, that's a great question. So it is kind of confusing. Like, we have this vaccine and you want me to take it and you're telling me I still have to wear a mask. So it does sound frustrating, right? And really, it gets down to there's still studies that need to be done. So the way the trials were set up is they were measuring infection and disease. They weren't looking at transmission, unfortunately. So the vaccine is building up your immunity. Your body can now is educated to recognize the virus. And we just don't know how much the education is. Is it enough to prevent the virus from infecting your cells, or is it enough to prevent the virus from causing disease? So you would think, well, 95% is great. That should mean the virus is completely eliminated from my body. And that might be the case, but we really have to do controlled studies to see if someone that's been vaccinated, do they have virus in their body? And is that virus at a level that could be transmitted from person to person? What also complicates that is we don't have a good handle yet scientifically how much virus is needed to get someone sick. So if for an overabundance of caution, that's what we tell people for now. You do, even if you're vaccinated, you still have to wear a mask. You still have to stay distance because, again, the vaccine is not only protecting you, it's more to protect the community. I tell people you wear a bike helmet or a seatbelt to protect you. A vaccine is to protect the people in your community. So you want to prevent that from being spread if the virus can still right. be spread. So I agree. It's kind of it's frustrating, right?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense to me because, like I said, if you can't catch it, you have nothing to transmit unless you are referring right. to that 5 to 6%
right.
that might
right. and,
turn out to be. And then in that case, like I said, it's not 100%. How could we ever go back right. to normal?
Hmm. Okay.
Right. Well, I think the goal is if we get a proportion of people vaccinated and getting back to that number again with vaccine efficacy. So just to kind of quickly define what that is. So the 95% you see, and then the other numbers you see like 70% or 80% fewer vaccines, that's in the controlled environment with what was the protection against disease in that controlled setting. When we go out to the larger community, there's different impacts of the communities, medications people are taking, because for those clinical trials, they're really set up so that there's two control groups that receive the vaccine and don't receive the vaccine, and they're as closely related as possible. When we go in the community, there's a lot of variables that weren't part of that study, so the efficacy might change a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jill,
with the vaccine too, is the idea of why do I still have to be careful? Is the other idea is it's 95%, which sounds great. So if we use that number, there's still 5% of people that get the vaccine and it doesn't work the same way. So they can still get sick. They can still pass the virus. So really the goal is to get a larger proportion vaccinated. And really any of these vaccines are going to be successfully able to do that is to reduce the spread in the community. And then once we get to that point, and again, it is, I am equally frustrated with, again, the speed. We're getting a bit picked up, but the speed has been a little slow. As we get to that herd immunity level, then things will return closer to normal in terms of, going to concerts, going to sporting events, not having to wear a mask out in restaurants.
Yeah.
So we'll get there. It's just, we're trying to learn as we're doing it as well.
Well, Jill, thank you very much for the call. Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest. And let's grab one more before the next break. Janice in Great Barrington. Janice, you're on.
Yes, I'd like to know the status of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, when it will be released. Will it come to our neck of the woods? And also, will it be able to be a booster for variants with some manipulation, as is anticipated with the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines? And is the Johnson & Johnson also an mRNA vaccine? I believe it is, but I'd like your response. Thank you.
Sure. Okay. So we're going to be fortunate to have a third vaccine in an arsenal, probably the estimates are around early March. So this vaccine has to go through the same process looking at safety and efficacy that the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines had to go through. And it's expected that it'll go through that the same way, and it's thought that it will get the same emergency use authorization. Now, this vaccine, the Johnson & Johnson, it's also called the Jensen vaccine. This is different. It's not an mRNA vaccine. It's an adenovirus-based vaccine like the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine. What this does is it uses a virus to basically shuttle or deliver instructions to our cells to make that virus spike protein. Instead of mRNA, it's using DNA, which is a different blueprint if you want to think of it that way. So the company is using a virus to deliver that to our cells. that blueprints get put into our cells then make the spike protein and it educates our immune system. The benefit with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is, one, it's a single shot, and then two, the storage requirements are different. So the hope is that once this vaccine is approved, it can be out in the community, and then we can vaccinate more people even faster than we are doing now. And you know, I think the numbers right now, we have 40 million people vaccinated, 15.5 have received two doses. So if we get a third vaccine out there, those numbers will go even higher. Now, in terms of its ability to protect against variants, they've done some studies to look at that. And it does seem to be able to, I'll bet, at a little less efficacy than the mRNA vaccines. Why that is not biologically certain, but it is still able to afford enough protection against severe disease and hospitalization with these variants.
Well, Janice, thank you very much. We got to take a break here. Dr. Eric Yeager of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences joins us, and the home stretch is straight ahead. Vox Pop on WAMC, Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Dr. Eric Yeager joins us, as he has done several times over the course of the past year or so. And I tell you what, we have about 20 emails here, Eric, but we'll do four or five, and then we'll go as quickly as we can. This one is from Rosalind. Does a lack of reaction to the vaccine indicate a less robust response and or less possible protection from COVID?
Thanks for the question, Rosalind. So with the vaccines, particularly with the second doses, people get to receive those. You probably hear maybe in the news or from friends and family, oh, I felt terrible after that second shot. So what does that mean? So the effects you feel from that shot is your immune response working against it. And there is some variability from person to person. There seems to be potentially an age-related difference where younger people might respond a bit more robustly than an older person. If a person's been previously exposed to COVID, they might work a little differently. But as of yet, in terms of looking at those studies, not everyone experienced muscle aches, pains, fever, chills, and headaches. It was about variations in the percentages, but it looked like irrespective of that, people still were protected. So I don't think how reactive are you to that second dose is really an indicator of, is the vaccine working like it should.
Okay, this one is from Khan in Sheffield. And you and I have actually talked about this in one show or another over the past year. Dogs as vectors? A few months ago, I read an article which said that research from Spain, I believe, had shown that having a dog in the house increased the danger of contracting COVID. That was it, as far as I can tell. One article. Any information on this? And that's from Khan in Sheffield.
Yeah, there's been a, so this is a, this particular virus is what we call a zoonotic disease. And there's a lot of fascinating science behind these diseases and the impact of climate change and human behavior. But these are viruses that can move from one species to humans for a variety of reasons. And an example of like this is influenza can move from birds to pigs to people. So it does appear as well that SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, again, was in bats and perhaps another animal before it jumped to us. And it still has an ability potentially to jump to other animals like minks. There's been a large cases of a disease in minks. But for dogs, there's been only a handful of cases. I think really the risk initially when we were thinking how this virus is spread is that perhaps someone, you know, coughs or sneezes, they pet their dog and their dog runs off to, you know, someone comes to the door, that person pets the dog and then they've got some of the virus onto their hands. They touch their eyes, their nose, or their mouth. So using a dog as potentially a vector in that way. I don't think there's been that much out there in terms of, if you're petting your dog licks you or anything like that, is that causing disease? I think it's more that it's an intermediary that might cause disease in a rare number of cases.
Okay, Barbara writes, I need to get a COVID test for work 1 to 2 days after I get my second COVID vaccine. Could the test show a positive result because of the vaccine?
So the way the vaccines work, both the mRNA and then the upcoming Johnson & Johnson, is they're just delivering the blueprint and your body makes the protein and your body will then become educated. The amount of genetic material present and the amount of protein present is too little to stimulate a positive test response. So if you had a rapid antigen test or PCR-based test, that shouldn't come up.
Well, that's good news.
Irrespective, they'll probably still, with the forms that we use at the college, we do ask people, have they been vaccinated, just to be safe. If you were to get a serological test, if your employer asked for a serological test, certainly after 2 weeks, your first dose, and most definitely 2 weeks after your second dose, you will have antibodies against the virus. And that's because you were vaccinated, not because you were infected.
Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest, and I got to say I'm impressed. You said irrespective twice and not irregardless. So good for you, my friend. Brian and Utica.
I try.
Brian, you're on. Go ahead. Hello, Brian.
Hello?
Yep, you're on.
Yes, hi. I'm sorry. Yeah, thank you very much, Ray. I think my initial question was returning transmission in fully vaccinated people. I think Dr. answered that question, but let me have him comment on AstraZeneca's vaccine in the U.K. I think they looked at transmissions of people who are vaccinated. Also, second question, rapid fire here. Pregnancy, is the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine safe for pregnant women? And third question rapidly would be concerning hepatitis B vaccine. I'm in the process of receiving the three Hep B vaccines. Should I worry about getting the COVID vaccine in addition to those, or should I wait, have a washout period? And I appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Okie doke. Thanks, Brian.
Sure. All right. Thank you, Brian. So first question about transmission. I haven't seen all the AstraZeneca data, but I do know the other companies making the vaccines are organizing trials to look at transmission. It's challenging to do because you really have to sample the person over time. And with those initial phase trials, they're really looking at efficacy and safety. So now they can take, now they have that information, they can look deeper into the ability of the vaccine to prevent transmission. And in terms of pregnancy, again, I think really I would recommend individuals contact their OBGYN to make sure that they get the okay from their doctor to get the vaccine. Currently, there's no data to say it's not safe. I know the World Health Organization put out some information that maybe pregnant women should wait, but the CDC put those individuals back on the list here. So I think talking to a doctor is the best case for that. And then lastly, I'm trying to think of the last question.
The HEP question.
HEP, yep, thank you. It's like a game show. Almost got it.
HEP for 10, Alex. So, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I think for that one, that what I've seen in recommendations is in the form you fill out, it asks if you're getting any other vaccine within the 14 days. And I think they're just looking to make sure they're still studying to make sure there's no competition between getting more than one vaccination. And people can get more than one vaccine at a time. Certainly, we give them the children and on their vaccine schedule. So I think right now it's in most cases, it's just because we're trying to learn how those people respond to the vaccine. I can't think of anything that would cause your response to Hep B to be different. And certainly the people have gotten more than one vaccine at a time. But definitely I would check with your primary care for that.
Brian, thanks a lot for the call. The number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Eric Yeager joins us today on Vox Pop. And Sue is in Saratoga. Hello, Sue. You're on.
Hi, thank you. Thanks very much for sharing your expertise. My question, my husband and I are both in our 70s and both now have two shots. We've been extremely isolated throughout this whole period. We would like now to enter into the world of my daughter, son-in-law, and grandson who are unvaccinated. And we think we can do that safely if we continue, safely for them, if we continue to otherwise isolate. Is that true?
Oh, thanks for your question, Sue. And that's a common question is I got my vaccine now. And why did I get it? I wanted to get it so I can kind of do the things I miss doing, like seeing family. And I feel for you not being able to see, my own mother and grandmother as regularly as I want to. You mentioned the key words there is continuing to follow safe practices. So, unfortunately, you can't say no masks, no distancing. So unfortunately, that has to stay true. But also, if you know the behaviors of the people you're hanging out with, family and friends. Again, we always talk about that bubble. It's really just still being cognizant of what's the risk of my interaction. Is it safe for me to go to the grocery store? Is it safe for me to get a cup of coffee? The vaccine, as I mentioned, doesn't make us bulletproof. Unfortunately, at this point, when we get it to the point where more people are vaccinated, there's less likely of the disease passing the community. But I think certainly with the vaccine, maybe start to venture out a little bit because I can really appreciate being stuck in house for that long is you want to see the people you miss, but do it in a safe way. Certainly if you could do it outdoors, would be great. If you go indoors, maybe have windows open. Really the same things we talked about in the past with doing things safely before the vaccine still holds true is you want to make sure people are distanced, make sure there's plenty of airflow. So if there is any virus in the area, it's quickly dispersed.
Sue, thank you so much for the call. It's 800-348-2551. Steve is in Kingston. Steve, you're on with Dr. Eric Yeager.
Hi, Dr. Yeager. My wife just got her first vaccine about a week or so ago, and within 2 days she had a horrible, painful, itching rash over her whole body except for her legs. And the question is, can she get the Moderna. Could she get the second Moderna shot? Or what's the alternative?
Sure. So in terms of the effects, I think it's always important there. I've told people that get the vaccine, and maybe you've done this, there's a service put out by the CDC called V-Safe. And what that does is it tracks any reactions people have to the vaccine, from no reactions to what your wife experienced. Because they do want to collect that data to ensure that the vaccine is still safe in the general public. Now, in terms of that response, that effect is probably on the rare side, but it does happen to some people. Why that happened, it's not quite clear. If she's had any pre-existing allergies to food or other products, or if she had reactions to vaccines in the past, maybe there's something there in her history and her genetics negative. That causes her to respond. In terms of the second vaccine, what they'll probably do is, again, because it sounds like it was something transient, she's better now, is that they would allow her to get the second shot, but they would monitor her more closely. So I imagine she probably had to wait 15 minutes for after that first shot. They'll probably have her wait at least 30 minutes after the second to make sure there's not a reaction after that.
I think it's just, like 2 days later, and she did have to be put on Medrol dose pack to get through it. And somebody suggested putting her on the Medrol for the next shot. Is that reasonable?
Yeah, I think it's worth reaching out to your primary care or if any other doctor she's working with, just to see if there's anything she should be on to prevent reactivity. Like our earlier caller talked about prednisone, so there's been kind of this anecdotal information to not take anything that's anti-inflammatory before the shot, but certainly after you could to mitigate the effects of the side effects of the vaccine. So that might be something to consider. But definitely I would touch base with a doctor to see what exactly she could take after that vaccine. But certainly there have been people that had a reaction following the first shot and they've gotten that second shot, but they've been monitored carefully to make sure that their reactivity can be managed. And in most cases, the responses that we've seen, I think the average is right now is between 2 to 5 people out of a million have had severe anaphylaxis, and they needed to have like antihistamines or adrenaline administered. So the numbers are still low, but they are there. So it's just tracking an individual, making sure that they do have a response. And in most cases, they're able to control those responses.
Dr. Eric Yeager is our guest. Charles is in Great Barrington. Charles, you're on.
Yes, hi. Dr. Yeager, my wife is asplenic, and she's been told for many years that she has increased susceptibility to both viruses and bacteria. And I'm wondering, I saw a study recently from Italy which said asplenic people are subject to greater risk. Wondering your opinion on that. I also saw a study earlier today from Columbia University. A couple of researchers there have come up with a lipopeptide, which they put in the form of a nasal spray, and they've tested it out on ferrets, which have a very similar respiratory system to humans. And apparently it was 100% effective in keeping the virus from attaching to the cells and replicating. So I wondered if you had an opinion on that.
Oh, that stuff sounds fascinating. I think there's still a need. We have vaccines, but there still is not a strongly approved antiviral. So we really want to find substances like that could stop infection. In my own research, we're looking at different materials that could stop COVID-19 infection, and those lipid proteins sound quite interesting. So I'll have to look up that paper. In terms of your wife and being asplenic, so that means that she lacks a spleen, and the reason why she may not respond to a vaccine as other people might and is more susceptible to other infections is that the spleen houses B cells, and B cells are the cells that produce our antibodies. Some people that don't have a spleen, they have trouble with infections with encapsulated bacteria like strep pneumo or Haemophilus influenza. And they may in some cases respond a little less vigorously to other types of vaccines. That said, it doesn't mean that the vaccine is ineffectual. So it's much better for this person to be vaccinated than to not be vaccinated because, again, natural infection can have complications where the vaccination can still afford protection. So I haven't seen anything in terms of direct instructions for people that are asplenic or hyposplenic about getting the vaccine. But certainly she should be able to mount a response to it and have some level of protection.
Well, Charles, thank you very much. We go to Scotia, New York. And Barry, you're on.
Hi, I have two questions. One, if you've tested positive for COVID and had no symptoms, That does not mean you have an immune system. I know you can get it again, but does not mean you're also unlikely to get very sick if you get it again. That was one. Secondly, I think there's some things I believe might help a little bit, and I want your opinion on it because I've heard no comment in the news about it. One, if you keep hydrated, is that a good thing, and will that lessen it? Secondly, it coagulates in the blood. It causes clots, which travel different parts of the body and can cause permanent damage. So if you take an anticoagulant, for example, if you're have coronary disease, you may be taking a baby aspirin every single day, which I do. Does that help in any way ordinary people, anybody from getting a less severe case? And thirdly, I've heard that if you sleep upright, your lungs will work better than if you sleep in the normal prone position. Would these things help in any way? Have you heard any research on it?
Well, the show's almost over, Barry. I'm glad your questions are done. Now you got a minute and a half. Sorry, here, Aaron. Go ahead.
I can do it. Well, thanks, Barry. So in terms of reinfection, so if you've been tested positive and you're asymptomatic, you may have some immune response to the virus. So there's a large proportion of people out there that were asymptomatic or may not even know they were infected and have some level of immunity. But the concern is there's question as to how long that immunity is going to last, whereas a vaccination, perhaps that immunity is more robust and more durable. In terms of hydration, I would support definitely proper nutrition, proper hydration, and rest and activity. And then if your body's working well, then your immune system is working well. So certainly you want to stay hydrated. For clots,
What about the aspirin?
What about the aspirin?
I think there hasn't been a randomized control study looking at aspirin per se. There are studies looking at clots because there was, and as you mentioned, varying cases where the virus causes clots, the immune response to the virus causes clots, and that causes a lot of complications. So there were studies looking at, should we give individuals like heparin or some other anticoagulant as a treatment? And those studies, I think, are still ongoing to see if there is any benefit. And again, you're looking at, is it a benefit in mild cases, severe cases, or cases that are hospitalized? So there's this kind of jury still out there. And I think that's with a lot of different therapies, like vitamin D is often proposed as a potential therapy. There's a lot of things that are tantalizing that could work, but they really have to be subjected to these rigorous randomized control studies to really be certain that it's something that we want to prescribe to an individual that we know it's going to have a benefit. The last one was just sleeping upright. I think sleep as you will. I think the only data I know of is really in patients that were on ventilators. They did find that if they position them in a different way, it takes some of the stress off the lungs and made it easier for those individuals to breathe, and there were better outcomes.
What about sleeping upside down? Is that good? Hanging by your ankles?
If it works.
Maybe not. All right, Eric, we're just about done here. By the way, has it surprised you? Now, you've been on since well before the vaccines came out, and you said, yeah, this is going to take a year, year and a half. Has it surprised you how fast it's been?
It definitely has surprised me. I was very hopeful. In terms of science, you always want to have some hope. And seeing how hard individuals were working around the clock to get these vaccines tested, it did exceed my expectations of how effective these vaccines were, that we actually will have three vaccines. There were so many being tested. I'd be happy if we had one. Now we have three. Yeah. To see that. And the other thing that's really been pleasing to me is to see my colleagues at the college and work hard to test students, to give out vaccines to the community. We have a lot of efforts going on. And then, like with you, Ray, and your efforts to educate the community and all of your listeners and the questions I get, there's been this evolution of literacy out there. Just the questions I get are fantastic, and they put me on my toes. So it's been a great run.
Well, you know, I hope you come back, but yet I hope you come. You don't have to come back, but I suspect you will. Hey, man, thanks a lot. We're out of time. I'll talk to you soon.
Take care, Ray.
Dr. Eric Yeager, thank you very much. The Lake George Land Conservancy is an underwriter of this program. The Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, providing more than 40 miles of trails for nature therapy and exploration beyond the shore of Lake George. HikeLakeGeorge.org. Gardner's Supply at Hadley Garden Center, Hadley, Massachusetts, locally owned and operated for over 50 years, offering indoor plants, garden seeds, and seed starting supplies, bird feeders, bird seed, and advice, HadleyGardenCenter.com. Once again, thanks to Dr. Eric Yeager for being here today. Thank you for listening. Apologies if your call didn't get through. He is a popular guest, and he will be back, I am sure. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Matt Plummer took the calls. Our producer's Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Oh, boy. Tomorrow on Food Friday, we welcome back Linda Kinlan. We'll talk about baking tomorrow at 2. Right now, stand by for The Capital Connection.